Jogcast NAMM 2012 Special, Day 1, with Libby Jones. Hello and welcome to the Jogcast. I'm Libby Jones, reporting from the first day of the National Astronomy Meeting in Manchester. The National Astronomy Meeting is an annual meeting hosted each year by a different university. This year, NAMM has approximately 900 delegates and is being hosted by the University of Manchester. So, as NAMM is on home turf, we thought we'd do a series of Jogcast specials, reporting from the conference each day. I've just been in the session Massive Stars from the Milky Way to Beyond the Local Group, and talking in that session was Dr. Ben Davies from the University of Cambridge. You were talking on red supergiants as cosmic abundance probes. So, hello and welcome to the Jogcast.
Hello, thanks.
First of all, we'd like to start off with, what is a red supergiant?
So a red supergiant is a star that begins its life about 8 times more massive than the Sun, a bit more than that. And once it's done hydrogen burning in its core, it puffs up to about the size of Jupiter's radius and becomes about a million times brighter than the Sun.
That's a very, very big star then, and very, very luminous. Mm-hmm. And how do you use these to probe cosmic abundances?
Well, because they're so bright, you can see them at extragalactic distances of millions of light years. You look at their spectra, you see absorption lines, and these absorption lines are due to metals such as iron, oxygen, silicon, and basically, just by measuring how strong those lines are, you can tell how much of that element there is. So if you see lots of iron absorption, you know the star's got lots of iron in it. And then that tells you about the chemical abundances of the host galaxy.
So these stars are just one part of the galaxy. Do you have to look at lots of stars to get an idea of the chemical abundance of each galaxy? Or can you tell it from just one star?
Well, one star gives you a good idea, but over an entire galaxy, you expect the abundances to vary. For example, in regions where you have high star formation rates, you produce more metals, and those metals get imprinted in the stars. So the idea is to do lots of stars and then effectively make a chemical abundance map of the whole galaxy.
So if you want to look at spectra, that involves quite a lot of telescope time.
Yeah.
And surely to see one of these objects, especially in different galaxies, that's going to require an awful lot of telescope time. Can you tell us how you can... Is there a way to speed this up, or do you actually just need to have days and days of big, big telescopes?
Well, you can speed it up by being a bit choosy about which parts of the spectrum you look at. So if you look at one particular part of the spectrum, you might see lots and lots of lines and they're all overlapping and it's a big mess. And so there's nothing you can do really. But if you look at another region of the spectrum, you might see a smaller number of lines that are well separated. And so you don't have to disperse the light quite as much. And because you're not spreading it as thinly, you don't need to observe it for quite as long to get the signal that you're looking for.
And how many objects have you managed to look at, and how many different galaxies have you managed to look at so far?
Well, we're in the early stages right now. So at the moment, we've looked at our galaxy and the two nearest ones, the large and small Magellanic clouds. But we are at the stage where we're going to start doing things that are a bit further away, which coincides with the new piece of kit that's going on the big telescope in Chile, where we'll be able to do not one star at once, but 20 odd all at the same time.
Oh, so wow, so you can get lots and lots and lots of stars, and mm-hmm. then you can get an idea of the chemical abundances as you go back in time. Is that the idea? So if you look to further redshifts or further away, the stars will have gone through less cycles and births and deaths, and so there'll be less elements. Is that what you're trying to probe?
Yeah, that's roughly it. Not so much with going back in time, but with galaxy mass. So a very massive galaxy has higher abundances than a lower massive galaxy, and this is due to in a very low mass galaxy, a supernova, which is producing all these heavy elements. When it goes off, it blows all those heavy elements out of the galaxy, and that never finds its way into the next generation of stars. So you see this relationship between how massive a galaxy is and its metal content, and that's what we're probing.
So the moment you've looked at the Milky Way, and then you looked at the LMC, which is a bit smaller than the Milky Way, and then the SMC, which is even smaller,
yeah.
Are you seeing what you're expected to see?
Yes, we are, which is good news. But at the moment, we're doing it on objects where we kind of know what the answer is going to be, just to test everything's working. And the next phase, we will start to reach out to less well-studied objects, and that's where we're going to really start to earn our money.
And is this quite a very good relationship between the mass of a host galaxy and the metallicity of the galaxy?
What do you mean by good?
Well,
It's all right.
So there's quite a lot of variables that we don't really know about yet, so we need to actually get a constraint.
That's right, yeah. So the problem that exists so far is we know this relationship exists, but we don't know precisely what it is, because we know one galaxy is more metal-rich than another one, but we don't know absolutely what that scale is. And so our goal is to measure that scale absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for being on the Jogcast.
Oh,
I wish you lots of time in the future on telescopes so you can get all these spectra, and good luck.
Yep, thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. During NAMM, there's lots of specialty lunches throughout the week. Today, it is the ALMA lunch, and I managed to catch up with Robert Lang about the latest status of the ALMA array and the results it's starting to take. You've been giving a talk about ALMA and the very first results. Can you briefly describe what you talked about today at NAMM?
So now we're getting to the point that the first early science observations from ALMA are hitting the streets, and my job was to summarise the current status of the array, what has happened in the construction project over the last few months, and what the current performance of the array is, and also to look forward to the development programme, because even though ALMA has not yet finished construction, we're still having to think about the upgrades and new things that we can do later on after the end of construction.
So how far into construction are we? How many dishes have we got on the site?
At the moment, we have 22 12-metre and 7 7-metre dishes on site. Essentially, all of the parts for 58 antennas have actually made it to Chile.
Oh, wow. And now that ALMA's being commissioned and we're getting through the first early science phases, can you briefly describe some of the first observations that ALMA's taken?
Yes, I mean, we've been concentrating on what's called science verification so far. That's observations that have been done by other instruments and we repeat with ALMA just to make sure that we get the right answer. So that covers everything from raster maps of the sun with single dishes, regions of star formation, the nearest active galaxy, Centaurus A. That's perhaps the most spectacular result that was shown in Richard Hills's talk today, out to very high redshift galaxies where we're starting to see redshifted line emission in quasars at a redshift of 4.
So redshift we mean by looking back into the universe at quite a long way back.
Exactly so, yes.
Fantastic. So we're seeing lots of new stuff, and ALMA's, I take it, they're improving and confirming what was previously observed.
Well, and indeed, in the later talks this morning, we started seeing the first of the early science results. Mark Swinbank from Durham gave a very nice talk where he was talking about a survey of submillimeter galaxies. These are things that had been imaged already by the APEX single dish in Chile. Now ALMA has imaged over 100 of them in a few minutes each, and we have much better fluxes, much better positions, and that's changing the whole situation of what they're identified with and what their redshifts are. ALMA is really working to do good science.
Fantastic. I wish you all the luck and planning for future upgrades as well with the new ALMA telescope. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to you, as always.
One of the main talks today is on Juno's mission to Jupiter, and I managed to have a few words with the keynote speaker during coffee. So joining us on the Jogcast today is Professor Fran Breganel from the University of Colorado, and you've been going to give a talk about the Juno mission to Jupiter. Can you tell us what's so unique about this mission?
Well, it's the first time we're going to be flying over the poles, looking down on the aurora. Then we're going to zoom underneath the radiation belts, avoid that hazardous area, over the top of the clouds. And by going very close to Jupiter, we will map out the gravity field and the magnetic field, and that'll tell us about what it's like inside.
That's going to be such a detailed look and that no one's ever seen before. Has anyone ever attempted such a dangerous mission and hazardous mission?
No, this is the closest we will have been mapping out these things. And it'll tell us about how the planet formed. And then that teaches us a bit about how the solar system formed, because Jupiter is the big planet in the solar system, the big bully in the solar system. There are now many giant planets around other stars. And so we're sort of learning about how different solar systems form. first understand ours in detail and then compare it with how exoplanets form in other places.
Because Jupiters are what we're detecting, mostly in exoplanets, aren't we?
So, that's right.
So if we get an idea with this mission, then we can have a much better idea about the other exoplanet systems as well.
Well, indeed. So we'll know how giant planets form. How they end up close to the star is another problem. Someone else will have to work on that one.
But this will give you lots of detail.
Indeed.
I wish you lots of luck. Thank you very much for joining
us
today.
It's a pleasure.
Bye-bye. During the conference, there is also many new results and interesting data released. And one such press release today is by George Bendo from the University of Manchester. Can you tell us what is your press release?
Well, I've been working for several years on processing images of nearby galaxies from data in the Spitzer Archive, and I recently had a paper accepted for publication based on these images, and at the same time, I've also made my images available on the web for the first time today.
This is new data that's been released that you've processed and made available for science publication, so anyone can go down and download and look at these pictures and do science with them straight away.
Anybody with a computer can just look at the images themselves if they want to.
And these images are quite cold, so they show cold dust around in different galaxies. Is that correct?
I actually have images of both hot dust and cold dust. The cold dust images are kind of blurry, but the hot dust images are actually very, very sharp looking.
And we can see these in all different galaxies, all the dust lanes around the spiral arms and all sorts of things like that.
Yes.
Thank you very much, George, for telling us about your press release. Well, that about wraps it up for the conference today. I hope you enjoyed some of the interviews and we'll bring you more throughout the week. This episode was produced, recorded and edited by Libby Jones. So, until tomorrow, jod on. Bye.